today's session was actually a last-minute session. Mingde, I think, sent me an SMS or left a message on my phone saying that we still can't find a speaker for this week. I've contacted all the monasteries. Everyone is busy. Being May, that you, those of you who are being brought up in a Buddhist country will know that May is usually a very busy month for monasteries because it's one of the important months in the Buddhist calendar. A lot of celebrations going on marking the birth, passing away, and the day the Buddha achieved enlightenment. So the original topic was Eightfold Path. Then when Mingde contacted me to do this talk, I say, let's maybe tweak it a bit. So I sent him what I had in mind and say, you go and think about a topic for this week. And I only found out about the topic from this week from the emails that you guys got. So I was like, oh, right. So that is the topic of my talk. Rich Buddhist, Poor Buddhist. Not exactly Robert Kiyosaki, who is the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Maybe a lot of you would have read that. I personally haven't. I can't draw any comparisons between what I'm talking here with what he's talking about. But from what I've heard, although talking about wealth, we cannot deviate away from topics like well-being, happiness, meaning of life. And with my limited knowledge that I have of Robert Kiyosaki's principles, I think he also gives quite a bit of emphasis on these aspects of wealth. Any of you have read his book? A copy version on novel or comic version? I thought it was a copy version. Comic version. Does he touch on these areas?
He mentioned something about YouTube donation as well. As part of your expense.
Yeah. As part of giving is a huge part of what he's spoken about. So when we talk about such an important thing, right, wealth, and clearly there's huge interest, right, given the presence in the room. Such an important area of wealth, right? I mean, we're not monastics, right? We are not renunciants where we've shaven our hair, we've taken on the robes, we've led a supposedly homeless life, but a simple life of reflection and contemplation. So we are not a person like that. Right? Clearly you're going through university and some of you are working as well. So wealth, money, rich, poor, those ideas are very much at the forefront of our awareness. Right, day in, day out. If you ask yourself, why are you doing the regular things that you are doing? Usually it's very much related to one or another aspect of wealth, or building up that career, right? Work, studies, professional development, that's very big, workshops. I've just come from a 3-day conference, so I'm pretty overwhelmed with information as well. So all these things that we are doing, a lot of that is directed towards creating a life that is comfortable, a rich life, a wealthy life. But then when we come to spirituality, and when we come to the Friday night English Dharma talks, there's a lot of emphasis about spirituality, you should live a simple life, right? You can go and shave your hair and live a contemplative life, and it's about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, you have to be aware of yourself, meditation. That is the core of the Buddha's teachings. But then what does Buddhism talk about when it comes to wealth? I've actually never really thought of that until recently when I had to do a workshop for Buddhism for young professionals. That really pushed me to really look into what the literature says about wealth when it comes to Buddhism. And I was quite amazed that there was quite a bit that the Buddha talked about. Because we shouldn't forget that when the Buddha was teaching in India, a lot of his scriptures that were passed down by monks and nuns. Right, through the oral tradition. For a few hundred years, a bit over 1,000 years still, that it was actually still an oral tradition. So the people who maintained this oral tradition were predominantly the monastics, the monks and the nuns, which who are like the specialists of Buddhist practice, right? They're like, you got your specialists, you know, your psychologist, your engineer and whatnot, but these people are the specialists of spiritual development. So the core or the main bulk of the teachings that have been passed down, which is the core and the key messages of the Buddha, are contained within the text. But then we almost forget when we look at the text that, wow, it sounds like the Buddha was always talking to monks and nuns only. But that's not the case. Among all his followers in India, when he was teaching for 45 years in his life, in fact, majority were lay people. And you can understand if you've got a Buddhist Vesak festival, right? Or any Buddhist festival. You look at the monasteries. In Australia, it's even more obvious. You got about 5 monks there, right? You got 500 lay people there. And this hasn't changed throughout time. And during the Buddha's time, it's assumed that it was about the same as well. So when he was teaching to the lay people, a lot of them were very interested with the key messages of what the Buddha said. Look into your life, reflect, and see the true nature of your experiences. That was a key message of the Buddha. A lot of people were very interested in that. But then after the talk, they have to go home, they have to work, they have to plow the fields, right? They have to go out fishing and do this and that, carpentry work and all that. They still have to go on with their lives. And when you are earning your keep, working for your livelihood, and then something huge happens, right? Global financial crisis, 2,600 years ago, let's say. Some form of crisis, right? Not sure whether it was global, but some form of crisis happens in the daily life of a lay person. What do you think they did? If you were, your teacher was the Buddha, during question time, right, you'll be asking him about some stuff related to lay people, right? So that caused me to think, hang on, there must be something that he was actually preaching to the monks and nuns. Yes, but there must be also other parts we are preached to lay people as well. So I began looking and searching, and I type in Google, Buddhism, wealth, money, economics, finance. As I was just chatting earlier, I just realized that I had a finance degree. I always forgotten about that. So that gives me a bit of credentials. So you're talking about finance, okay? But that's not true. Let's talk about it from a purely Buddhist perspective. What did the Buddha say about wealth? When people ask him about wealth, initially I thought, it was years of unexamined belief, I thought the Buddha would say, oh yeah, why bother with so much money? Just give it all away, just shave your hair, right? Come and live the holy life. I thought it could have been a bit of that. But then that wasn't the case at all. The more I looked, the more I found the different scriptures, the different teachings that it has given, although in a smaller proportion compared to the key messages, there was one set of scriptures that were talking about wealth per se. He talks about relationships within lay people as well. He talks about different aspects of lay person's life. But he did spend also time talking about wealth in Buddhism. And what we're talking about is not some huge meaningful idea between what is real wealth, is a meaningful well-being. It's not about that. We're talking about just money, right? Buddha talking about money. So this is what started this inquiry and also formed the basis of the talk tonight. So hopefully by the end of tonight, we have a bit more understanding of what is the Buddha's view on money. And that's why rich Buddhists, poor Buddhists. Today, as I was at the conference, I told my colleagues that they're all Buddhists. A lot of very senior Buddhist teachers as well. And one of them was Dr. Eng Kong Tan. Some of you may have met him. I was saying that, yeah, tonight I have to give a talk. Rich Buddhists, poor Buddhists. And then he says, there are no poor Buddhists. Right? And I said, well, that's very true, but I still need to give this talk. So, we are looking at the teaching, specifically exploring teachings for the householder. And then at the end of it, I will then link it, hopefully linking it into a greater context, and what Eng Kong meant by, there are no poor Buddhists. And let's have a look whether we have managed to do that. The Buddha said there are four kinds of happiness that a householder could enjoy. Really? Someone said, really? Enjoy? Happiness? Householder? Doesn't quite fit with Buddhist teachings. It's not. There are actually four kinds of householder happiness. What do you think they are? Now, this is not for monastics. This is purely for householders, all right? So shake yourself out of the robes and the all that for the time being. Just think purely of at the very lay person's level. What do you think will be the kinds of happiness the householder enjoys from the Buddha's perspective?
Enough to eat.
Enough to eat, yep.
Security.
Safety. You guys are still very half spiritual. That's good. I'll share with you what the four kinds of happiness, householders' happiness that the Buddha once taught, right? I see different times when people ask him the same question, he responds quite differently. So the first one, right, I nearly couldn't believe it when I saw this. He says, the first type of householders' happiness is ownership. Being able to own something. It's like, what? Isn't Buddhism about renunciation? Isn't it about detachment? And here the Buddha says, one of the householder's happiness is ownership. You have your, well, I guess 2,600 years ago, you have your nice little hut. You got your fields to plow. You may have one or two buffaloes. You may have a horse. You seldom see horse in India, though. Okay, horse. Cows. Or if you're rich, elephant, right? A bullock cart or something. The ability to have ownership over something. So that is one source of happiness, he said. Right, so ownership. So the Buddha is not about saying that you shouldn't own anything as a Buddhist. Give everything away. Live very simply. Right? We should have a one-room apartment. You go in, there's a bed, there's a sink, there's a toilet bowl. That's why sometimes Buddhists are misunderstood as saying that you don't contribute to the economy. Well, but then here the Buddha says ownership is one source of happiness. Now we will understand these a bit more, right? I'm giving you the framework to work with right now. So first one is ownership. Second one, so first one I was shocked, right? Second one I fell off the chair when I heard this. The second one he said, enjoyment. Enjoyment? Really? Then a lot of, when I share this with people, they say, shouldn't Buddhists like just be very simple, branded clothing? Hey, not right. Enjoyment? Cannot. Good food? No way. Fine dining? Cannot. It's not about that. The Buddha says enjoyment is another thing that a householder can enjoy. Not for monastics, strictly for householders, alright? Enjoyment. And when we talk about enjoyment, it is about this day in and day out things. Right? Enjoyment of the different, you're able to have good food. Right? It's not just sustaining your body, good food. For monks and nuns, it is about sustenance of the body and the mind. But for lay people, it says that you can enjoy. Right? But there is more, there's more disclaimer to come, right, later. So the story is never that straightforward. But enjoyment. So I fell off my chair. Well, not literally, but I was like, okay. So enjoyment is another thing, source of happiness. And the third one, this one is a big advice to the world. Especially for a lot of us with a plastic piece of thing in our wallet. Not your student card, your credit card. He says one of the kind of happiness out of the four is freedom from debt. Freedom from debt. Now when the global financial crisis hit, the first people to suffer in fact are those with high debt. I'm not saying that debt is right or wrong, but I'm just saying an observation here. Those with a high debt actually suffer more, right? If you, all else being equal. I can't remember what's that finance term when you have all else being equal. some Latin term. Any of you finance trained here? Oh, good. This audience is easy. Freedom from debt. If you have more debt, then you have more suffering. But in fact, what they are seeing now is that medium-sized business, some of them are actually thriving in the economical crisis. And the reason being that these companies do not have any debt. So now is a good time when the big ones are struggling because they have so much exposure. They're having to cut back. As they cut back, where do the clients go? Where do the customers go? They go the next level down, which are the medium-sized companies who are able to still continue. And if there's no customer, close shop, never mind. Right, finish at 3 o'clock. But if you have debt, you can't close shop at 3 o'clock. Right, you have to still keep pushing, and finding more and more customers, more business. So freedom from debt is one of the happiness that the Buddha says. And at a personal level as well, I've heard of people whereby if you ask them what they're most fearful about, one of the things that they're most fearful about is every month, maybe nowadays it's a bit different because electronic, digital, but every month, around the same time, when he or she opens the letterbox and takes it out and sees either the logo or the return address, which is very familiar to them, of a bank, or Visa, MasterCard, HSBC, or whatever that is issuing it. When they see that, they really panic. There are really people like that. They really, really panic when they see that. Because throughout the month, they swipe, right? And the end of the month comes, panic when they come and go and open the bill for the credit card. You see how that interferes with our sense of happiness, our sense of peacefulness as a householder. Of course, monks and nuns, I don't think they borrow money, do they? Not really. Okay, more applying for lay people. So freedom from debt is the other one. And the fourth one is blamelessness or morality, that people cannot put blame on you. Right? So it's very strongly related to morality. But when we look at the four kinds of happiness that can be enjoyed by a householder, we realize that the first one, number two, number three, are all related to ching, money, right? Ownership. You can't have ownership without money. Enjoyment. Let's say good food. Right? You can't go to a good restaurant without money. And if you are the best cook, say, I'll do it myself, you still need money to buy the ingredients, right? So money. Freedom from debt. Those people who go into debt, usually is because they are short of money. So when you have money, then you have more likelihood of being in a state of freedom from debt. Then the fourth one, blamelessness, is not directly related. But out of the four kinds of happiness that the Buddha talked about, three are directly related to wealth. So this got me thinking and more. And went on a bit more on my research as well to look into the different scriptures of what they spoke about wealth. And then I found a bit more here and there. But let's now go into, when you need money, how do you get money? You work, right? So the Buddha did talk about wealth creation. And this is associated with the Noble Eightfold Path. Which part do you guys know? Right livelihood. So the Buddha did specifically talk about over and over again this notion of right livelihood. So now that we say that in Buddhism money is important, right? It's not that money is not important. A lot of people have this misconception that money is useless, you should give it all away. But in fact, you shouldn't give it all away, which we'll see later on. But then how do we gain money? How do we earn money? The basic policy, the basic tenet or principle of Buddhist livelihood is the no-harm policy. And what do we mean by no-harm policy? The Buddha did specifically say, avoid trading in weapons. Right? It can be weapons of mass destruction. So don't trade bombs or guns, grenades, large samurai swords. I don't know whether that counts or not. But generally, weapons that can cause damage, and harm to other people. That is one thing to avoid. There's a meditation teacher in Burma. He's no longer around. His name is Sayaji Ubakin. Some of you may know him or know him from his student currently teaching who's still around, Goenka. Right? Goenka's teacher, Sayaji Ubakin. He was a Burmese teacher, Burmese meditation teacher, and a lot of people from all over the world come and study with him. And of all the people, one of them was a top scientist. And this is, we're talking about world-class scientists. And one of them who came to study with him in his meditation center, and they've got this little, it's interesting, they call it the meditation cell. And the reason you call it a meditation, where else do you use the word cell? Prisons, right? So it's, I've been there in Burma in Ubakin Center. You open the door, the room is only as big as around this area that you sit. So these are called meditation cells, right? So you go in, you close the door, absolutely dark, nothing inside. You just, what you do is meditate. Some of you probably freak out with that idea, but it's quite comfortable in there. It's quite quiet, and you know. But anyway, that's besides the point. So there was once I can't remember from which country he was from, a scientist, a very top scientist, came and studied with Sayaji Ubakin. And during the practice sessions, so we all go in, they all go into their cells. So one of his assistant teachers at that time was Goenka, and he related this story later on. He says that there was once Ubakin told Goenka, they go and check it with this person's practice. Because you have to check, you know, sometimes you just see whether they've fallen asleep or are they still doing okay in there, you know. So he, being the assistant teacher, he went around checking, and then he was asked to check in this person. Open the door. What he saw was this person was doing this, right? And then he said, oh, this is weird. Closed back the door, went back to Ubakin. I don't think he's doing well, right? Something is happening in there. So Ubakin just laughed. He said, never mind. Next day, same thing again. He said, Goenka, you better go and check and see this, how this scientist fellow is doing. So this time, he went in. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But this was from Goenka's own words. He says that, I saw him. I still can't picture it in my head. Although I've been to the cell, I looked at it. It's like, how is this going to work? He was upside down. His head was on the ground. As he was shaking, the whole body was upside down. Amazing, right? And Goenka said, oh, close the door back. Back to Ubakin. Ubakin just laughed. He's like, nah, it's fine. He'll be okay. Right? He's a very experienced meditation teacher. So he makes this judgment and said, no, he's going to pull through. It's going to be fine. And then later on, Goenka found out that what is this person's day job when he was back in his own country? He was an engineer. He was a top scientist. He was an engineer. A very noble profession. He's expert in the purification of metal. Right, I don't have an engineering background. I don't know how difficult that is. Apparently that is not easy to do. Well, that was about 50 years ago. Purification of metal. So that the metal can be so pure that the structures of the bonding is so strong. Engineer? Alright. I can still get away with this. So very strong bonding. So that it can withstand a lot of heat and great impact. So that was his specialty. Amazing, beautiful, brilliant mind, right? But then, his lab was specialized in using this metal. Maybe Pele can understand with some engineering background. Using this metal for what? As the casing for bombs. So he was designing the casing for bombs and the metal component and the constitution that creates the most biggest maximum impact upon explosion. So imagine what type of mind he has. Day in, day out, you're thinking, oh, how to kill more? If we design this way, aerospace, dynamic, if we push us this and that, this was his day in and day out job. Right? That's why when he was looking within his mind, there were so much of these things that were coming up for him. And that's why he was meditating upside down. But there's... Don't worry, there's a happy ending to this story. After he completed the retreat, he felt so much relief, relaxed. Before that, he was a very uptight person, always arguing with the wife and this and that, the whole family was upside down. Very brilliant person, but life was falling apart. After this, he saw what was in his mind through meditation, felt so much relaxed, so much relief, like a huge burden taken off, working with his internal struggles, and then went on and continued to improve his life. So that fellow did well. So Wu Baqin was right. But this highlights that what you do in your profession, imagine day in, day out doing the same thing. You spend the majority of your life, of your adult life, actually working, right? Apart from sleeping, the next big thing, sometimes it's the other way around, is working. You spend the majority of your day working, day in, day out, day in, day out, right? If your work is about cheating, killing, harming, how can I gain, squeeze more out of my customers, this and that, harming, killing, how can I kill more people? Hopefully none of us have that intention. But imagine if you have that day in, day out. What happens? You form very strong habits within yourself. And neuroscience in modern days is very advanced. It can say that, for those of you with some biological background, you know the neurons in our head fire, right? Chemical reaction, electric impulses, fire. The more you fire, the stronger the connections are formed. Right, this is neuroplasticity for those of you who understands this. The more, if A and B always occurs together, there's strong relationship between the neurons that connect A and B, strong firing. So day in, day out, the firing of your neurons is killing, die, 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 aggression, aggression, bomb, 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 right? Those neurons, those part of your brain, those sections of your memory become very thick. Right, this is not me say, this is neuroscience say. So that becomes habit. Habit has a neurological, biological basis. The brain actually changes. So imagine, depending on what type of your work, that creates a habitual reaction. And even a biological change in your brain. So weapons is something to avoid. The trait in human beings, that's something that the Buddha says not to do. At this point, some of the people who work in HR or organizational psychology, goodness, don't worry, it's not about that. What we're talking about here is like trading of people's lives, slavery, things like that, buying and selling of people's lives. And it's quite common. Now you don't see it as much, not in this country at least, but if you go to certain countries, you still see that in happening. And 2,000 over years ago, a lot of that was happening. And Buddha says, no, don't have ownership over another person's life. Don't trade their lives, human beings. Right? And the other things that he talks about was intoxicants, poisons, and trading in meat as well, because there's a lot of killing involved in meat. Right? Intoxicants is selling a lot of alcohol, drugs, all these things, not good for the mind and the brain. Right? You may have temporary relief, but it's an escape. It goes against clarity and peacefulness and real happiness of the mind. So it says those things that you avoid. Poisons, clearly, right? Something goes down, everyone die more. Again, right? When you're designing a poison, you don't say, I'm designing this poison to have minimal impact on lives. You don't design poisons like that, right? So these things are what the Buddha says, try to avoid. Now in Buddhism, there's no black and white. It doesn't say that, no, you should never do it, full stop, no argument. It says that these things cause harm. Go and look at it and see whether that is true or not. Now, 2,500 over years ago, things were quite different. There was not this globalization whereby one company is dealing with another or the other side of the world. So nowadays, what happens is that we're in the information technology and some say there's knowledge and intelligence age, whereby everything is linked. So one type of research could be easily used for something else, right? So if you may be specialist in the company of just doing metal sheets, but you don't know where these metal sheets are going. It could be going to build an orphanage in Sri Lanka or Cambodia, or it could be going to build a tank in Russia. I don't know why I always associate tanks with Russia. My apology. Very bad. But you get the idea, right? The thing is, the Buddha, when he talks about livelihood, he gives you guidelines, but he says that be constantly aware of how your life is impacting other people. and more importantly, how your life is impacting your own spiritual development. I'll give you an example, right? Some of the work that people have are very noble, but then it may cause some harm to certain types of people. Okay, there was once when they wanted, some people I know very well, very close in the family, went over to China to say that they want to build a bridge. Sounds good, right? Building a bridge, improving infrastructure. So when they went there to look at the site and surveying the site, and they were having lunch, there was a huge protest outside with all the villagers. No bridge, no bridge. Because although the bridge is good, but it creates a lot of residual effect for everyone else. So that's why then they eventually pulled out. I'm sure other people went in to do the same, but these family members actually chose not to go ahead. They made a conscious choice. So from the most extreme, saying that you're dealing in weapons, intoxicants and everything, the definitely clear cut no. And then you have this gray area. Sometimes you're doing good, but it may bring some harm based on your own judgment. Now, the other part is what you seldom see. I'm a psychologist, right? Good profession. Helping people. Imagine day in, day out, helping people, compassion, firing. Good. Loving kindness, right? Sometimes it's a bit difficult, but generally that's the idea, okay? Very good profession. Or a doctor, all right? Very good profession, helping other people of their suffering. But if I'm a psychologist and I'm working 6 days a week, and let's say if I have a family, if I have children, I'm working 6 days a week, and then on the seventh day, I have a bit of break, I spend a bit of time with family, and then after that, the next day, I go back to work again. From the surface, it looks like it's good life, helping other people. On your free day, you're not doing anything else, you're going to help, you're going to spend time with the family, but it is not a balanced life. The Buddha says everything has to come back to your own spiritual development. If you can use your work as spiritual development, that's fine. But if you work so hard and you've burnt yourself out so much that you cannot maintain the state of the being, the state of your own well-being and therefore the well-being of other people, then there's no point. I went through a stage where I was working too hard. Working. I got my research. I have to do talks, workshops. And then I realized that, hang on, something is tipped off balance here. Something is missing. The actual formal setting out time for more intensive spiritual practice. And I felt lopsided. I don't know whether some of you feel that or not. When you're overly focused on one thing, although it's a very good thing, if it's not in balance with the other aspects of your life, then that is not a good livelihood either. So you've got a clear nose, the black and whites, the grey area that you can make judgments. But also be careful, because we are all intellectuals here. And I can say that everyone here, right, I can assume with quite high confidence that we have a kind heart that is quite well developed. So you'd be doing a lot of things. But also don't forget that under the guises of that, you may actually start to veer off, you don't even know, because you're so tired, you're so worn out. So be aware of that. So when we're talking about right livelihood, you can look at all the traditional stuff saying that no harm to avoid this. But real life example, especially in modern days, tells me that there's another aspect that we have to watch out, which is the overly busy life that we have. Because that tends to tip things off balance. So this is something for you to ponder. So we have talked about the types of happiness a householder enjoys. Three of them related to wealth. We've talked about how you earn wealth. And now let's talk more specifically just on money itself. How the Buddha says is the usefulness of the money. Now money is important, right? There's no doubt about that. And Buddhism doesn't doubt that either. A lot of people think that Buddhists are just living in their own world whereby things just go around by donation. We don't have that assumption, okay? If there is a place like that, let me know. It's not like that. Buddhism says that the Buddha's view on wealth can be contained in these three things that I've summarized. The first one, The Buddhism doesn't have a maximum cap on your amount of wealth. Buddhism doesn't say that you should not have an annual income of more than 100,000 per annum. If not, you have a spiritual tax. It's not like that. The Buddha never have a maximum cap on our wealth. And the reason you can see it very clearly, during the Buddha's time, who were his disciples? The monastics, of course. Within the lay community, you have very common folk, villagers, fishermen, farmers, and all that. But also, a lot of his students, or his disciples, were actually kings, ministers, very, very wealthy merchants, businessmen. The wealthy merchants, you all often hear Ananda Pindika, that's one of them. How many have heard of Ananda Pindika's story? Or heard of Ananda Pindika? Oh, tough crowd, huh? Now, Ananda Pindika, he was a very wealthy merchant during the Buddha's time. He's a huge supporter of the Buddha. And the first time he came across the Buddha's teaching, he was elated. It's like amazing. For once, I met someone who talks sense, logic, simple, down to earth, no belief, no bullshit. Not exactly Ananda Pindika's words, but this was the feeling that he had, right? And then he got so happy that he says, "You have to come and teach in the busiest point, busiest part of India, Shravasti." Shravasti is in the trade route between the east and the west. It's like a junction from, you have Europe on one hand, linking to China on the other side, and India below. Shravasti sits on the center. So this is like the crossroads whereby different nations come and trade. A lot of trade route happening. And him being a merchant, he knows where the market is, right? So he says, you have to come and teach because you can benefit so many people. You can help so many people. So then he asked the Buddha, will you come and teach if I set up a center for you? Right, he has money. So he said, I'm going to set up a center for you. So then the Buddha says, okay, that's fine. If you can make the arrangements, I will go. So he went back to Shravasti and he was looking. The Buddha says, he asked the Buddha, what would be a suitable place? He says, not in the center of the marketplace. It's going to be a bit difficult to teach there. Not too far away that it becomes too difficult to travel. Somewhere in between that's quiet enough that you can still travel quite safely for people going there from the villages, from the city and all. So when Ananda Pindika went back to Shravasti, he then went and surveyed the different places. He came to a very nice park. And this park, he thought was the perfect place because it's not too far away from the city, not too deserted and beautiful environment. Right? If you walk in there, you're already feeling calm. Plus the Buddha's teaching, hiya. Right, it's like, you know, who wants spa resorts when you can have that, right? So he thought this was the best place. So then he asked around who actually owned that place. And it was owned by the Prince Jeta. Right? At this point, some of you, the brain lights up. Ah, I know this story now. Right? So he said that I will go and buy this piece of land and I'm going to build a monastery so that the Buddha can come and teach and benefit all the people who is going to come. So then he went to the prince to say that, can I please buy your land? The prince laughed. Why are you going to buy my land? Right? Who are you to buy my land? He said that, please, I would really, really like to buy your land. So why? Why do you want to buy your land? Then he says that, I've met the Buddha. He's a great teacher. And I'm going to set up a place so that he can benefit a lot of people. Especially in this busy part of India. And then he says like, and then he says, name any price that you can. Any price I'll pay. I'll immediately say, okay. The prince said, ha, wait till you hear my proposal of how much it costs. Says, the prince was thinking, nah, he won't actually pay that amount of money. Just to sort of to shoo him away, he says, all right, fine. Because he knows that this guy is very persistent. Right? Because Ananda Pindika said, we can have it the short way or the long way. It's up to you. I'm here until I buy this land. So I said, okay. This piece of land is worth as much as gold covers it. A gold coin, as much of that area a gold coin covers, that much I'll sell it to you. You know how much this means. That means it's like, imagine the most expensive... Let me reframe it. Let's look at a piece of gold, right? Actual piece of gold. That much area it is actually worth. So to buy this room, you have to pretty much measure the area and measure the size of the gold coin and match it up. And that's a lot of money. So what did Ananda Pindiga say? Deal, no problem. The prince was shocked. He fell off his horse, probably. So the prince was like, okay, if this is really what you want, okay, that's fine, right? I'll sell it to you. Immediately, cartloads of money, huge heaps of gold, were being then spread on the ground just to show that, yeah, this is as much I'm buying. So cartloads and cartloads of money, gold coin, right, spread on the ground to buy the land. So the prince was very rich. Ananda Pindika, huge investment, and that's just buying the land. If you go and see, there's the ancient site is still there right now in India. It's an archaeological site. I've been there. Shravasti, the ruins of it is still there. And it's not like a small little one room like this. Right? It's a huge proper monastery. And they haven't even excavated everything yet. And he built this whole huge complex for the Buddha to teach. So this is someone with so much wealth. But the Buddha, did he say that? Ananda Pindika, your account is too much money in there, you shouldn't have too much money. Did the Buddha say that? No. The Buddha never put a cap on the amount of wealth that you can have. Just so that I'm not being blamed to being a sexist. Another one of the Buddha's chief disciples, lay community, is Mother Vishakha. Another very, very rich lady. Alright? So, very, very rich lady. And if you go to right now to India, you can still see the site, Buparama. There's a huge monastery that goes for acres, actually. It's so big that Mother Vishakha just gave money and gave all the jewelry away just to build that amount, that place. Now, the topic of discussion here is not how big the monastery is, how much wealth they have. Right? Mother Vishakha's wealth is probably something like Ananda Pindika's. But did the Buddha say, no, you shouldn't have so much money, you should give it all away? No. But out of their own generosity, of course, they built these places. But the Buddha never put a maximum cap on how much money you can have. So let us be sure of this point. But he says that everything has to be in balance. Now this is roughly in the words of the Buddha, translated in English, of course. He says that your lifestyle should be neither extravagant nor miserly. That means it shouldn't, your lifestyle, the amount of money is one thing, but your lifestyle shouldn't be too extravagant. Or, you know, some people, they have so much money, but they save so much, they're so stingy. Right? There's nothing wrong having saving things. It's fine, it's good. But you shouldn't be extreme. Extreme, it becomes obsessive compulsive saving. Right? That's not good. And this is the next part that's very important. He says, your lifestyle should neither be extravagant nor miserly, and your income should be in excess of your expenses. The Buddha was a financial planner. Right? The basic rule of financial planning is, wealth management 101 is, your income should be more than your expenses, so that you create more worth rather than your liabilities. Right? Property assets should be more than your liabilities. If it's the other way around, what happens? You have debt. And when you have debt, you lose the peace of your mind. Okay? So it says very clearly that income should be in excess of expenses. So remember this, please. If it's anything else that you forget from tonight, remember when you're working, income should be more than expenses. Okay? This is what the Buddha said. It's not my words. So that's the first point. In fact, in other scriptures, he says that poverty creates problems. In the Chakravarti Sihavada Sutta, he says that poverty creates potential jealousy and creates taking out of arms and creates a lot of conflict. And through conflict reduces our beauty, our lifespan, our state of mind. Right? He does it in a very systematic way. But you can understand, if a person who is always not having enough money to even have the basic nutrients, right? That could cause a lot of problem. Well, on a basic level, physically, you are unable to take care of yourself. Lifespan shortened, the Buddha said. your beauty or your pleasantness of your physical body, everything goes down. Interpersonal relationship wise, we create envy, jealousy, and then you will want to steal. A lot of crime happens because of poverty. So it says that poverty is a problem. It says that poverty is not good. So again, some of the misunderstanding that people have, Buddhists should be poor. Who said that? Right? That's not true. Right? Poverty in fact creates problems. In the Mahayana Sutta, the Sutra of 20 plight of mankind, the first plight that the Buddha says is poverty. When you have poverty, it's very difficult. Life is very, very harsh on you. But where we define poverty, that is up to individual. Some people can have millions in their account, but still say that I'm so poor because they're associating with all the billionaires. Right? My limousine is hired. My friend has two of his own. I'm so poor. Right? It can be subjective, but see where you put poverty. But the Buddha says the most basic poverty, that is not good. But everything else, that will come in later when we talk about contentment. But we're talking about the most extreme poverty, that creates problems. That's what the Buddha says. So you should be balanced, your income should be more than the expenses, and eventually you'll build your way there. So this is the first principle. There's no maximum cap for wealth accumulation in Buddhism. Second principle, it's not judged by the amount, but by the usefulness of your wealth. It's not about the amount that you have, it's how you use it. This is very clear in when the Buddha spoke about the usefulness of wealth. This is another teaching that he gave in the Adiya Sutta. He says there are five uses of wealth. What do you think they are? Five. Let's see whether we can outsmart the Buddha. Come on. He's one and we've got a few people here. Five usefulness of wealth. Wow, you're all very generous, aren't you? You don't use much wealth. You can plow it onto the table if you want. Shopping? Okay.
Investment?
Stock investment? Okay.
Donations?
Feed yourself?
Education?
Sorry. Savings?
Medication?
What else?
Six
C's? What is a six C right now? Have they changed that?
I don't know. Is it five or six C's?
I think
it's five in Singapore last time.
What are the five or six C's? Car.
Credit card.
Car.
Condominiums.
Condominium. What else?
Cash.
Credit cards,
yes. What else? What else? Usefulness of wealth. The Buddha gave five. But actually, he was cheating a bit because it wasn't really five, because each sometimes within one he expends another five. But let's say about five, right?
Help
other people. What else? You don't care about your relatives or your friends.
Help your family.
Help your family. You don't care about your friends. Help your friends. Okay. The first one that he says was giving the pleasure and satisfaction for your parents, your partner, your children, and those who depend on you. You see how when I say one is actually quite a number? So it says offering pleasure and satisfaction to your parents, your partner, your children, and those who depend on you. Without money, you cannot help support these people. Essentially, the Buddha says wealth is important in supporting these people around you. And these are very close people within you, right? Blood, bound by blood. Your parents, your partner, the children, those who depend on you, relatives and all that. So that falls into that category. The second one, the pleasure and satisfaction for friends and associates. If you're going to have friends come over to your place, you have to offer them something, right? At least a glass of water. So you need money to buy the glass and to pay Sydney Water for water, right? So that's the basic. So if you want to entertain having friends around, having associates, business associates, you need money. So that is a usefulness of wealth. This is coming from the Buddha. Being able to help you to create and foster the relationships with your friends and your associates. right? The third one, which some of you have covered. The general idea is to ward off future misfortunes. And in the olden days, it's fire, flood, government, thieves, hateful heirs, these things. So in modern days, it's probably still fire, flood, maybe less so here, but actually in Queensland, you'll see. Government, suddenly there's this tax, that tax. Thieves, still relevant. Hateful heirs, maybe not as much, right? In the olden days, government, the kingdom was, you may have a good king, but you actually don't know the second, whether the son or the daughter will be good as the heir. So hateful heirs, very, very nasty rulers. So the general principle is to ward off future misfortune, and like you say, you're having savings, right? Having enough for your medical needs, all these things. It falls within that category. Warding off future misfortune, that's the third one. The fourth one, this I find it very interesting, because the Buddha talks about the fivefold offerings. There are five directions or five places that you should make offerings to. And these fives are, first one, relatives. You should make a conscious decision to have offerings to your relatives. This is what the Buddha says. In order to create harmony, you give offerings to your relatives. And this doesn't mean money or anything, but it's a gesture of giving something, fruit or whatever. Right? If you're very rich, you can give more. If you're just basic life, there are different things. This is one of the offerings that he says. The second offering, he says, guests. Guests who come to you. Right? Invited or uninvited. So this guest is whoever you invite into your home. People that come to you. Guests that you invite, you then invite them in. These are the offerings that you need to make. And like again, I say offering doesn't mean money. It could be a bowl of peanuts or something, right? It's the use of wealth. The third one, the departed. Now this is quite interesting. And this is not covered in the earlier ones. Departed. Honoring our departed. It says that it's important for us to give offerings to our departed. Then you'd be thinking, it's a bit freaky, isn't it? If they're departed, how are you going to do offerings for them? Or maybe I'm the only one who was freaked out. When we talk about offering for the departed, it means giving in their name. Right? And this will mean from the moment of death, giving them a good funeral. Right? Honoring the departed could be giving out things on behalf of their name, in memory of them, as their legacy, as something to remember them by. You know, some people, some families are so poor that they can't afford a proper funeral. I was just at a conference and yesterday, Geraldine Cox, she started a orphanage in Cambodia, right? And she said that one of the most heartbreaking things was when a elderly grandmother with her very young granddaughter came to the door of her orphanage. And you can see that this is a very serene old lady. And the young child was very, very sick, coughing. And about to, you know that the child doesn't have a long lifespan anymore. And this grandmother told Geraldine, can you please take her in? Because we are so poor that we can't afford a proper funeral for this child. And because of infection, the support system that is not in place in orphanage, unfortunately Geraldine, with a very painful heart, had to turn this grandmother and child away. We don't think of these things, do we? We don't think that funeral costs a lot. Actually, it does. If those of you who have been through funerals or who have been involved in arranging funerals, it does add up. As you can see in the advertisements, you can take out like the death insurance right now, whereby, you know, if your loved one dies, then they will foot the bill. There is actually quite a bit to do with funeral in honoring the departed in the proper culturally appropriate manner. So that is what the Buddha says. You also have to use your wealth in honoring the departed and doing things on their behalf, in their name. All right, this. And the fourth one, offerings to the government. Now the Buddha says, you must pay taxes. Right? These are from the Buddha's words. That you have to, one of the five offerings, the fourth one is offering to government. You must, because the government takes care of you. They maintain the roads, maintain safety, maintain this and that. You have to pay your taxes. So the idea of taxes has been around for a long, long time. And during the Buddha's time, he says, government, you have to pay your taxes. The fifth one, offering to the devas. Right? The traditional term is devas, or the heavenly beings, or the gods, or God. It says that in the commentaries, in brackets, according to one's faith. Remember, he wasn't just teaching to Buddhists. In fact, he wasn't even interested to convert anyone. If you really look at other parts of his life story, when people say, can I be your disciple? He says, go back and honor your teacher still, but take what you can. Right? He wasn't talking to Buddhists only. He says, one of the offerings that you can make is based on your own faith, honoring to God, to the devas, to the spirits, if that is your faith, if that is your belief. You should have one of the fivefold offerings, this is one of them. So we talked about four usefulness of wealth. Pleasure and satisfaction for parents, partners, children, and those who depend on us. Second one to friends and associates. The third one is warding off future misfortune. The fourth one is five offerings. And the last one, he says that you have to make specific intention to have offerings to those who live a good holy life. Now the reason that I speculate is because this creates a relationship with the monastics or the people of the wise contemplatives. Right? He doesn't specify in his teaching in this particular time that you should offer to Buddhist Sangha. No. He says offer to those who are leading a contemplative, reflective, holy life. Support them. Although you're not living that way, support them. Because this creates then a relationship with these people. So that you can get wise advice. When you're going to give dana, you have to go to at least a monastery. Right? If you're going there, if you're used to doing donations or giving food, you have to be actually physically there. But this creates a relationship with a community that you can turn to. Which is very, very important for our physical, mental, emotional well-being. Because these are teachers who can guide us in times of need. So it says particularly, he didn't include this in the five offerings, he included it specifically in one big thing that offerings that result, this is the translation, offerings that result in happiness, including to the virtuous and followers of the holy life. That means giving those who have opted to live a good, virtuous, ethical life of contemplative and reflection. And that can lead to happiness because you're always in touch with these people who can teach you so much about life. So this is what he says, the five usefulness of wealth. And then this is not the most interesting part for me in this scripture. Then I read on. Then he said, this is the point that was of most interest to me. He says that when you have wealth, you spend it in these five ways. So even when your wealth depletes, when you have no more wealth, when your wealth is used up for one reason or another, even when wealth depletes, then one reflects that when I have wealth, I've used it in these five ways and therefore does not create remorse. This was very clearly stated in this teaching. He says that when you have money, you use it in these five ways, and when you suddenly don't have money, you can then reflect back and say that I've used it in the best possible manner. And even though I do not have it now, I do not have regret because I've used it to the best of my ability. A person who uses wealth in this manner will not have regret when they do not have money. And this is a very important concept because wealth, as we know, especially in the recent times of the global financial crisis, wealth is actually quite an abstract idea. It's actually an idea, isn't it? It's when you and I agree how much this is worth. Right? Ming-De agrees, I agree that this piece is $1. Right? 10 years' time, we say, no, this is 1 cent. If I say that this is $1, everyone says 1 cent. What's the value of this? 1 cent. Right? It's actually a lot of ideas that's happening. So wealth can fluctuate. Even if you say, I store gold bars in my little lock and little safe, right? That's very solid. You look at the gold prices, it goes up and down, doesn't it? So wealth fluctuates as well. So the Buddha says, when you have wealth and you use it in these ways, then you will not have regret. And this is a very important teaching that I find that we don't tend to do. When we have money, we use it, but we don't use it wisely. So that when we don't have it, we fall into a lot of difficulties and we have a lot of remorse. So this is what the teachings that he gave in the Adiya Sutta. So it's not judged by the amount, but by the usefulness of your wealth. That's the second principle. So far we talked about wealth being used to support other people and support yourself at a physical level. But also, one of the very, very important things is that wealth has to be used to support your spiritual development. The Buddha says, a hungry man is not ready for Dharma. Right? And I think, I haven't found it yet, he will say, a very, very poor person is not ready for Dharma either. I would think so. When you are so poor that you are worrying about what you're going to have the meal for next meal, you don't have the space to actually reflect and think about certain issues in life, don't you? If any of you know the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, some of you heard it. It's basically a hierarchy, and on the top is self-actualization, which is spiritual development, personal development, all that. But it says that Maslow proposes that the basic needs has to be satisfied first. And what's the most bottom one? Food or safety? I was hoping that one of you can tell me. Something along those lines, like safety, right? Your physical needs, including food. And then as it works up, finally self-actualization. When your basic needs are not taken care of, you cannot talk about spiritual development. When your stomach is hungry, you have no space. Hopefully you all had some dinner. When your stomach is hungry, you're not ready for Dharma. I heard in one of the Buddha's story when someone came and he was very hungry, the Buddha says, give that man some food. Because if he's hungry, he can only crawl, crawl, right? The Buddha says, you know, four noble truths, crawl, crawl. You do not have the mental capacity to receive what that is going to be taught, right? So the basic needs has to be there. So the wealth has to be used to support yourself, support those who depend on you, support the relationships that you have, and the most important is supporting your spiritual development. So like I say, if I was a psychologist working myself to death, and I have no time, I lose the awareness of what I'm doing, right? Just the drag, it's all about making money, charging the next client, I'm going to be a billionaire psychologist, work until, I don't know, whatever shape I'm in, and forget my spiritual development. That is not right livelihood. That's not. It may be a noble profession, but if you don't balance that with your spiritual life, then no. As far as Buddhism is concerned, that doesn't nurture and support your spiritual life, your spiritual development. And this is something that we have to ponder in the modern day world, whereby more and more is required of us. And more that we are keen to actually buy into, because we need that plasma TV or that iPod or I this, I that, that you have to work so much more. And that brings me to the third principle, knowing contentment. Contentment is very important when it comes to wealth. So the third Buddhist principle when it comes to wealth is knowing contentment. When the first time I said this, people say, huh? No contentment? K-N-O-W, no contentment, knowing contentment. The Buddha says, santuti paraman dhanam. I thought I'll spin in a Pali word just to make it a bit more authentic. It means contentment is the greatest blessing or greatest wealth. Contentment. Santuti paraman dhanam. Because if you don't have contentment, you can have everything in the world, but at the end of the day, you're still needing more. Like I say, first you change from us. Second-hand Ford Festiva, you change into a Toyota Echo, you change into a Honda Accord, you change into a Mercedes-Benz, the 7 Series BMW, a hired limousine, you buy your own limousine, Ferrari, limousine and a Ferrari, 5 different types of Ferrari, 5 different types of limousine, one for each working day. It never finishes, right? It keeps going on and on. And this reminds me of a story between the fisherman and the businessman. Some of you may have heard this from Ajahn Brahm's book. Don't spoil it for the others, okay? I'll try to recreate this. So there was once a business professor. That was what Ajahn Brahm said. A business professor or a businessman. Very good in the economics, business, right? MBA and all that. Great. Went to a very lovely fishing village for a holiday. A nice fishing resort, go for a holiday. And then as he was walking around with his child one day, he saw a fisherman midday, right? Just after lunch, he was walking and taking a stroll, as healthy people should do. Taking a stroll after meals. He saw this fisherman mending his net. Yeah, look at his watch. Mending his net, look at his watch, okay? After lunch. I think he's going out for a second round. Well, first round's net torn and going out for a second. So, hey, fisherman, so what are you doing? Mending my net. So, how's the catch today? You know, normal surface talk. Oh, good catch in the morning. So, are you going out again for in the afternoon? The fisherman looked at him. Why? Why am I going to go out in the afternoon? I've already gone out in the morning. Didn't I tell you it was a good catch? Anyway, then he says, but if you go in the morning, you come back, you mend your net, that's fine. Good, increase productivity by mending net so that it doesn't escape. Then if you then you still have half a day, you go out again. Then you have a second catch of fish. That's it. Why would I want to do that? So you can double your income, you know, business mind ticking away. You know, if those of you who know businessmen who are born in the business person's family, you will know the business mind is always thinking, right? These people go on tour and everything they can see is more money, opportunity, opportunity. So this is what was happening for this person, right? This fishing village talking to this fisherman. He said, but this is a good opportunity. Afternoon you go out, right? You come in the evening, it's still good. So what do you do in the rest of the afternoon then? He said, well, I mend my net, I listen to some music, I dance around, I spend some I threw that in. spend some time with my children and, yeah, read a book or, yeah, that. It says, you see, if you go out in the second round, you come back, you double your income. So the fisherman, this is quite a new idea to him. So, why? So I double my income, so what? So how many fishing boats you got? I got one. So if you double your income for long enough, you can buy a second boat. Why do I want to buy a second boat? I can't row two boats at the same time. I said, no. If you double your income long enough, you can even hire someone to take the boat out. And if you even double your income long enough, you can not even go out that much. You can just manage the market and look for more buyers and, you know, set up a system here. You know, all the business mind thinking, logistics, you can get people to come in and, you know, big fridge and everything. So I said, you can then buy a second fishing boat. And so then what happens? Oh, then after you can buy a third one. And you change, instead of the rowing one, motorboat, right? Instead of a net, I don't know what else they use. Yeah, instead of pulling the net in, you can have motor to reel it in, right? Come on, I can't remember the full story, but you get the idea, right? Let's say, why? What then? After that, you can start a big fishing company. Right there, you can have fleets of boats. You can go to deeper waters. You know, some of you watch the deep sea fishing. Right, they go and fish for crabs and stuff. You can send people out. You don't even need to go. You can send people out and manage the business. And then what? It says, and then you make it so big that eventually you can put your company on the stock market. So you build all this up and then you sell it. Why? You say, ha, so that you can take holidays like I do, and spend time listening to music, dancing around, and spending time with the children. And this is the point that my fisherman was quite scratching his head. I don't know how to break this to you, but I'm actually doing that right now. By not going out to fish in the afternoon to begin with. So this is when you see how, because of the lack of contentment, this can keep building. Right? And you can see that a lot of business people, when they actually retire, they struggle. Because all throughout their lives, they're thinking of making more and more money, more and more money. So all the neural firings is what? Money, right? More money, right? Okay, when you see a person, it's this dollar sign, right? Wilson, not worth much, not many contacts. Kai, very social person, good market. Cha-ching, right? So imagine your whole life is measured by money, 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 money. What happens to a relationship? You don't have enough time for a relationship. And I work a lot with children these days, and it's sad. I do family therapy, working with a lot of families. It's so hard to sometimes get the parent to come in, the working parent, because they say that I'm so busy that I don't have time for my child. When the child is depressed, anxious, or not doing well, and we say that we actually have to speak with you, it's so difficult to actually sometimes get parents to come in. We sometimes lose track. Is it really that important to get that next Mercedes-Benz as opposed to being there for your child when your child develops? Being there for your partner when your partner is in need of help? That's why sometimes people struggle when they retire, because they've got all this huge mansion, and when they retire, their children go to university or they go to work, they leave their home environment, emptiness, right? Big, beautiful house, husband and wife, I don't quite know her anymore, she doesn't quite know me anymore, because life has gone apart. You do not invest on your relationships anymore, because you're so driven by craving, by all this money, money, money. Everything is cha-ching, 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 right? Oh, child education, how much does he need, right? It's not about that. It comes down to the simplest things, relationships. So if you do not know contentment, you can get yourself into a lot of difficulties. There's one of the great holy meditation teachers from India, not in the Buddhist tradition, but I find that he has a lot of wisdom. He says something along the lines like this. We spend half of our life earning money, and spend another half of us of our life using money to earn back our health and time, which is, in brackets, our life. I think sometimes if you're not careful, that is the case. We spend so much of our life working, 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 earning, 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 and then when we have everything, because we have damaged our lives, damaged our relationship, damaged so many things in the process, we spend the next half of our life using our money to buy back this, buy back that. Right? Through all the stress, this problem, that problem, then you have to, in the end, you earn all this money and you hand it to who? Your doctor? Right?
Psychologist.
Your psychologist? Your lawyer? If it comes very, very bad, you hand it to your lawyer. Divorce? Lawsuits? All these legal problems? You hand it to them. Then they are very happy. Yes, yes, yes. Right? What's the point? It is when we do not know contentment that we buy into this cycle. And it's hard. I know it's very difficult because everyone is doing that out there. When we sit down and talk to people, right? If you're in my age group right now, the thing to talk about is, so when are you buying your first property? So looking at good time to buy. So it's all about buying. Right? Luckily, maybe you're in university, you talk about, oh, Dharma, oh, how's your meditation going? How's your relationship going? Huh? Are you spending enough time with your... So maybe... But if we're not careful, we keep dragged into this. So when we know contentment, we know when to pause. We know when to say that 5-day weeks or even 4-day weeks is enough. Recently, one of my friends says that suddenly she got laid off of her work, so she got retrenched overnight. Let's say tomorrow you don't need to come back. Suddenly she said it wasn't a breakdown. She didn't have a nervous breakdown, she had a nervous breakthrough. She says, actually I've worked so much for what? I've got enough to use, I've got enough savings for the future. So the next job that she's got right now, she said, I'm working 3 days a week right now, so that I can have time to spend doing other things like volunteering, my meditation practice, spending time with close ones, family, relatives, who are not going to be around forever. So there was a breakthrough for her. But sometimes when we're in this so much, we forget contentment, we don't have these breakthroughs. We get dragged by our emotions. It's, in fact, craving is a form of like an emotion as well. We get dragged like a cow being dragged by the nose ring. So this, the third point is knowing contentment. So the first point is no maximum cap, earn as much as you can, using the right manner. Second one is not judged by the amount, but by the usefulness of your wealth. And third one is knowing contentment. It's very important. So, before I summarize everything, there's also another teaching that the Buddha gave about the divisions of our wealth. He says that our wealth should be divided into four parts. The first time when I taught, I said four equal parts. But upon reflection, I don't think it's correct. It's the idea of having four different types of money set aside. the four types are, first one, for your daily use. Right, you have a daily savings account. Money goes in and out, right? Daily use, the Buddha says. Second one, for emergencies. This could be investing in modern times in health insurance, in insurance, that's fine. But also having a set of money set aside in case anything happens. If you crash your car or something, right? And then it's, your hospital bills are paid by insurance, but there are other things that you have to pay for. Any emergencies, you set aside an amount of money they can access quite quickly, but it's not necessary in your day-to-day life living. That's the second one. The third one, this is very interesting. The Buddha, I think a Buddha was a financial analyst, like I say. It says investments. You need to use money to grow money. This one, it's like, wow, really? So the Buddha was a financial planner, a financial analyst. So he says, use your money to grow more money. So this can go back into your business if you're a businessman, right? And to also have money set aside to continue growing, investments, properties, and all these things, investments, to growing money, the third one. And the fourth one is giving. Giving to support other people. Like I say, in the usefulness of wealth, actually, out of the five things, remember the five usefulness of wealth? Supporting yourself, your parents, supporting your friends and relatives. Out of the five of them, four of them are about offering to others. So in the division of wealth, the Buddha says one part has to be set aside to be given. Sometimes you can go either way. Sometimes people are so stingy or miserly that they do not give at all. Everything is every single cent. They calculate to the nth degree. Right? That's not good. But on the other hand, people say, and this is probably in a Buddhist cultural environment, you get a lot of this. Oh, monastery, building something. Let's donate as much as we can. But don't worry about our savings. This is like our karma bank, right? You'll add a lot of merits. There'll be beautiful big mansion up in heaven. No one has ever come back to tell us whether it's there or not, right? That is based on our own greed as well, if you're not careful. So the Buddha says you have to have four parts, not just one part. And sometimes because of our own greed for merits or karma or whatever it is, or misinformation, we say, oh, some good teacher is preaching. Doesn't matter, all my savings, child education, don't worry, that will sort itself out. There will be very wise children if we donate this and give everything away. What's the point? The Buddha says, no. Don't. You should have four parts and have those four parts, one part only for giving. The others, you have to support yourself and those who depend on you. So this is the four part of the division of wealth. Okay? Now I'll just come to the summary of my entire talk. I did pretty well.
Yeah.
When I first wrote this, it was for a half an hour talk. I like to talk. Now to summarize, when we talk about the Buddha's teachings, it's a lot to do with the key messages of the Buddha's teaching is teaching you how to live a life that is conducive for peacefulness, for happiness. Right, it's a lot about introspection, looking within the nature of your mind, and coming out of the day-to-day life sufferings that we have. Those are the key messages. But also within that, he says that also within that, it is important that as lay people that we learn to live a life that is good. And being having a good life, one part of that within the Eightfold Path, he says, is right livelihood. He says that it's important for us that in our worldly living, that we do well as a human being, that we contribute properly to society and to those who are supporting us. Because he says, in the worldly living, you too can attain very high states of enlightenment and liberation, or in other words, spiritual advancement. You can, as a layperson, in the Buddha's stories, there are so many of them, ministers, businessmen, farmers, fishermen, all who have gone to very high states of deep realization as a lay person. So it says that that is entirely possible. So the key message is to live a life of wisdom. Living a life of wisdom embedded in your worldly living. And you can't just excel well in spiritual life without excelling well as a human being. And when he spoke about wealth, he says that you can earn as much as you can in the right way. That was right livelihood. You can earn as much as you can in the right with the right means. But also, remember that everything is in a constant flow of change. including the wealth. So don't just keep earning. That's fine. But also in the process, keep growing and growing spiritually. So that when you come across different obstacles in your career path, in your worldly life, in your relationships, you know how to deal with them. That is requires wisdom and compassion. And if you only invest in one part of your life, which is the earning as much as you can, to the detriment of your own spiritual development, then in fact, there is no wealth in that part of your life. Like I said, if you earn so much money, your relationships are no good, you don't know your partner anymore, you're not connected with your family anymore, then there's no point. You're missing the big picture here. So, the Buddha says, as a lay person, earn as much as you can with the right means, but always contemplate and remember that things are in a constant flow of change, and including a very big thing is your wealth. So true wealth as a lay person comes from both sides. One is material wealth. You have to have that. The Buddha is never ever against that. But then the true wealth needs to encompass for a lay person a real stability and strength of the mind that is unshaken no matter what happens. Whether it's a crisis, whether it's a personal crisis, or much larger scale crisis, a mind that remains unshaken and strong, and continue to love and care for others. Now that is the true wealth when we talk about rich and poor Buddhists. So it's up to you where you want to put your life at. The Buddha always says, I open this to you, and I tell you the reasons why. The rest is up to you. But we should never forget what true wealth actually means. Material and spiritual wealth. Okay? Thank you. Questions? I charge for financial planning, yeah? Questions? What?
You know when you talk about right livelihood, you right livelihood usually encompasses things that you stay away from harm. Right? So that also involves in trading in meat, right? I think a lot of people will then start to think, oh, if I don't trade in meat, then can I even eat meat and all these things? What do you think?
But I say Buddhism never has very strict yes or no, right? If you really look at, unless it's to do with monastics, how they conduct themselves, the Buddha is very strict on that. But when it comes to the more general teaching, he never said that vegetarianism is important. Right? Let's get this right. In fact, if you know the story of Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin who opposed him and formed his own Sangha and broke away from him, the Buddha's cousin Devadatta, before he did that, he proposed a few things that within the Sangha that one should change in Buddhism, in the community of monks and nuns. And one of them was vegetarianism, that all the monks and nuns should become vegetarians. The Buddha disagreed. He disagreed with all his proposals. None of them were approved. And one of them was vegetarianism. Well, from a monastic point of view, they are going out to beg for whatever that's available. Right? So whatever that's been given, meat or not meat, they take it. Right? You take it with a sense of sustaining your body. Now when we look at lay people's life, it's very much up to individuals. The Buddha never said you should or shouldn't be. What you eat is to sustain your own body. And if you feel that eating meat is something that you don't sit well with yourself, then don't. And if you feel that eating meat is something that you're used to and you're still continuing, that's fine, continue on. Right? But keep practicing. Because this will become clearer and clearer to you in your own spiritual development. As you practice, you will know how different nutrients affect the body. Whether it's meat, vegetarian. So it's important for us to know our body, to know, be aware of the nutrients that we're putting in, including mental nutrients, but now we're talking just about physical nutrients. The Buddha talked about four types of nutrients. Right? Out of the four, one of that is food. So you're aware of how the impact is. And in actual fact, meat or no meat, in daily life, day in, day out, there's a lot of things that we're involved in, even water, right? If you're cooking and boiling water, there's actually a lot of organisms in there as well. What Buddhism accepts is that living in this world, like I say with right livelihood as well, harm is always there. You cannot separate yourself from harm. This is just the way of life as it is. This is a reality of your life. But it's up to you as a personal choice whether you want to become vegetarian or not. Let me ask you, if a person who eats anything, right, if there's meat, eat meat, if there's vegetables, eat vegetables, versus someone who is a vegetarian, very strict vegetarian, so when he goes out with a friend, if there's meat, he gets angry, right, starts scolding the friends, why you eat meat, okay, some of you may have friends like that, I used to, and then they're very picky with their food, right, they eat a bit, they're not happy with food, this, that, right, if it's not cooked properly, they start scolding the people. Which do you think is better? I wouldn't say that one is better than the other, right? But I find that based on food alone, it's hard to judge a person's character. It's not about that. You make your own judgments as to what type of food you want. But vegetarianism sometimes can become an ideal. It can be a very strong idea that you're attaching to so hard that it creates so much conflict in your life. I have friends whereby they say that, you know, every certain type of day, they have to be vegetarian. So that's fine. They have their observation days. I respect that fully. And then it's a mother-in-law's birthday. Right? And then they all prepare very nice food. In fact, when the mother-in-law's birthday, the mother-in-law cooks. And mother-in-laws usually cook a lot of meat. Well, this particular one did. And then the question was, should I eat or not? I say it's up to you. But think of what is the biggest bigger problem here. Is it eating that piece of meat, which you'll eat the next day anyway, if it's just the day of observance, or the potential conflict and difficulties that may come up, that people question your faith? Especially when Buddhism doesn't strictly say that you have to be a vegetarian. I'm not a vegetarian. Okay? When you ask me when I'm on retreats, I prefer vegetarian because it's lighter on the body. It just helps with the stability of the mind a bit. Right? But day in, day out, I eat whatever that is there. When the Buddha says don't trade in meat, is don't be the person who is actually doing a lot of killing. Because if you're doing that, day in, day out, you're just killing, killing, killing. The amount of meat that we eat compared to a person working in the abattoir, right? It's actually quite different, the amount of lives that we take. But if it does resonate with you that in saying that, no, I don't think meat is right, then that's fine. That's that sort of, I'm not giving you a black and white answer either, but I challenge you to think of the different aspects. And Jim always mentions the story of a very pious Buddhist who found a dog. Right? He's probably spoken about this before. How many of you have heard that story? Ah, good audience. That's a very pious Buddhist, and she's a vegetarian. So suddenly one day that she was going across the market, and she saw a stray dog, very sick, very ill. And out of compassion, she brings the stray dog back home. Right? How many of you have heard this story? No? Okay, well, go on. Okay, Minta has heard this. It's okay, quiet. Okay? And then after that, she nurses the dog, everything that's good. Right, dog's getting better, all nurse, wash the wounds very carefully. And then come meal time, right? And she's a vegetarian. So then she will cook vegetarian food for the dog. All the vegetables. And then she gives the food to the dog. And then the dog sniffs, right? Goes away. Dog doesn't like vegetarian food. Dog's nature is not eating vegetables unless they are sick. Right? They eat grass. So usually they're meat eaters. Anyway, this dog smelled, went away. So being a very pious Buddhist, then she gives a sermon, right? She says, oh, dog. You know why you're born as a dog? Because of your bad karma. And if you continue to eat more meat, more bad karma for you. So now, you should eat vegetarian food so that you cleanse your karma. Now eat. Dog looks at her, smells the food, walks away again. Right? Dog couldn't understand. And then she starts getting a bit annoyed. What is this dog doing? I'm trying to do the best for him. He says, no, no, no. Okay? Then, really, push the dog. Come on. Right? Dog's head. Food. Come on. Come on, dog. Right? Not very happy dog. And then after that, dog refuses. Out of the kindness of her heart, she starts scolding and yelling, eat, eat. Dog refuses to eat. It's not the nature of the dog to eat vegetables. It's, to eat is like, you know, it's like us eating sand. Probably. Right? Pushes the dog down. And then takes out a cane and starts hitting the dog. Why are you not eating? Why are you not eating? Now this story shows a few things. Sometimes we can be overly attached to certain ideas that we lose the plot. Why do people become vegetarians to begin with? They say love of animals. But when you really see how they interact with animals, it's not necessarily the case. I'm not saying all vegetarians are like that. I'm just saying that we have to be a bit more comprehensive and holistic in our approach. Right? So if you're a vegetarian, I have full respect towards you. Make sure your nutrients are enough. Make sure that you go to a proper nutritionist as well to ensure that you have enough nutrients. Right? Because I come across different people who are lack of certain type of nutrients because they're vegetarian. But yet I got a lot of friends who are vegetarians who are doing very, very well as well. But continue to develop spiritually so you won't get stuck into these questions on yes or no. I can't give you a full answer either. The Buddha never said that you should or shouldn't be a vegetarian. He kept quiet when it was proposed to him that one should be a vegetarian. No. Actually, I think he said no. Out of the propositions of Devadatta, he said no. Okay, any other question? One more question before I finish, if there's any. Yep.
So, because we said that the avatars do the killing, right? So, if there's no avatars doing the killing, then there would be no meat for people to eat.
Mm.
But that's bad, right? Because they're doing the killing, so it's bad
for them. So it's up to you. If you feel that is how you're contributing to the killing process, then don't. And it's perfectly fine. But if you stop, and rather saying that in a more ideal sense of a larger sense, that if everyone stops and then, you know, what will happen and such, I think it's quite hypothetical as well. I don't mean to shortchange it either. I think that it's possible. And I think what is more possible right now, and there's a movement, is to improve the state of the animals. Right? How chicken... The typical one is battery hens. Did any of you watch Jamie Oliver's thing on the battery hens? It's basically how hens are, you know, the eggs that we get, they're very cheap, right? And these hens are actually they have no room to move. It's only a packing space, and they keep eating and keep laying eggs. It's like a machine. Right? And the movement now is to create free range for them to have space, proper diet, proper exercise space, stretching space, so that they can lay eggs in a more normal fashion. So I think those type of causes are worthwhile supporting. But if you personally feel that if you don't eat meat, so that you're not contributing to that process, then that's fine. But the thing is the interrelatedness of human beings. That's true. But the Buddha also said that in this world, you cannot escape the karmic existence. This is the karmic existence. But it comes down to intention, firstly. Secondly, continue to practice. So that you can then make better judgments of where you should be or should not be. What I'm saying is that there are flip sides on both. Whether you're a vegetarian or you're a meat eater, there are flip sides on both. It's more important to look at your attachment. If you look on your attachment, these things will become easier for you. So if someone say that, let's go for vegetarian, I say, yeah, that's fine. If I'm eating with my vegetarian friend, yeah, vegetarian, absolutely, no problem. As long as we get the right nutrients as well. So this is a more balanced middle path that's closer to the heart of Buddhism. Okay, because if you want to take it to the nth degree, you know, a lot of medicine and everything, it's a lot about, you know, killing organisms and things like that as well. Or I say boiling water. The Buddha took up a bowl of water and says that there are countless organisms in there as well. So, you know, in this existence, you can't separate that. But as much as possible, you will reduce harm. But if it's a personal choice to reduce harm, by all means, do that. And stop that. But I think something that we can all work on is to improve the state of animals in their life. Okay?
I've got a comment about that. Some people, they improve their conditions for animals, like in the guise of saying that it's better for the animals, but it's actually the intent of improving the meat for human use.
Yeah. There's a lot of different intentions that we can't really be aware and be sure of all of that. So it comes back to Buddhism, comes back to your own intentions as well. But be sure of what your intentions are. You cannot control others, right? You can try to spread awareness. I'm all for that. I'm all for activists. I've got a lot of friends who are activists, but really hardcore activists. And I think that they're doing a great job. Yeah, I think that's true. That yeah, a lot of people, although under the guises of like, I mean, in Australia, free range is not a label that is regulated. So they can call it free range, but you know, free range can mean anything. But I agree. But the more of the awareness of the community, it will start shifting things bit by bit. And that is something that's a more achievable goal. Okay? Yeah, but I fully agree that, yeah, there's some people who are out for no good. But they have their own intentions. They have their own type of distress that they are going to undergo and experience in their own lives. But we take care of where we are. If the decision is right for you, go for it. Okay? I think we should finish now. If you have questions, you can come by and chat with me afterwards. So I'll just shut this down. Okay.